Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
New Mexico man dies in two-vehicle collision. A Department of Public Safety press release detailed, a 53-year-old New Mexico man died in a two-vehicle collision on Saturday in Winkler County. The reported fatal collision happened at 11:43 p.m. Saturday near the intersection of State Highway 302 and Farm-to-Market Road 874, about 3 miles west of Kermit. DPS stated Ryan J. McCabe, 31, of Sanders, Arizona, was driving a 2016 Jeep Cherokee with passenger 53-year-old Leonardo Allen Ballone of Gallup, New Mexico. Carlos Garcia, 27, of Chaparral, New Mexico, was driving a 2016 Kenworth truck with trailer. Preliminary information showed the Kenworth with trailer was traveling westbound on State Highway 302, while the Jeep was traveling south on Farm-to-Market Road 874 and failed to yield the right-of-way of the intersection of Farm-to-Market Road 874 and State Highway 302. The Jeep pulled out in front of the Kenworth and was struck by the Kenworth. McCabe was transported to Winkler County Hospital in serious condition, while Ballone was pronounced dead at the scene by Judge Kerry Jones. McCabe and Ballone were both wearing their seatbelts. Garcia wasn't injured in the collision, and he was wearing his seatbelt. Library to host Valentine's Day event. The Ector County Library is hosting a Valentine's Day event. The event is scheduled from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. Tuesday at the Ector County Library, located at 321 West 5th Street. It will include giveaways, face painting, and fun for all ages. Obituary for February 7th. Mark Anthony Tony Corbell passed away Friday, February 3rd, at his home in Pretty, Texas. He was born November 30th, 1949, in Ozona to Mark Corbell and R.V. Lee Scroggins Corbell, November 30th, 1949, in Ozona. He is survived by his wife, Diane Corbell, of Pretty, his sons, Travis Corbell of San Angelo, Jason Corbell of Odessa, and several grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Visitation will be Tuesday, February 7th, from 5 p.m. till 7 p.m. at Stacy Wilkins Funeral Home, Goldwaith, Texas. Services will be Wednesday, February 8th at 1 p.m. at Zion Lutheran Church, Pretty. Pastor Mark Schimmel will officiate. Interment will follow at St. John Cemetery, Pretty, Texas.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, February 6th. Cervical cancer. Vaccine, screenings, ways to combat cervical cancer. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. Screening and getting the vaccine for cervical cancer are two of the ways to help combat it. Dr. Sanchita Yadala, an obstetrician gynecologist at Medical Center Hospital ProCare Women's Clinic, said cervical cancer is the third most common gynecological cancer diagnosis. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website, each year in the United States, about 13,000 new cases of cervical cancer are diagnosed, and about 4,000 women die of it. Quote, Hispanic women have the highest rates of developing cervical cancer, and Black women have the highest rates of dying from cervical cancer, the site detailed. The State Department of Health and Human Services recognized January as Cervical Cancer Awareness Month. In Africa and Central America, cervical cancer is the leading cause of cancer-related deaths among women, Yadala said. Quote, In terms of cancer deaths, it was 11th amongst all the cancer in women and 9th amongst all of the cancers for mortality. Incidence has decreased, though, more than 50% in the past 30 years because of the screening, which is a pap smear. But it's much more common, particularly in countries who don't have the screening. Out of the patients who do get diagnosed with cervical cancer, 50% of them have never had a pap smear. That tells you that screening saves lives and it helps to catch the disease early. 10% of them did not have the pap smear in the 5 years before the cancer diagnosis. They would have had time if they had come in and had the pap smear done to catch it earlier, when it was in the earlier phase, the precancer phase, Yadala said. Overall risk in the U.S. is decreasing, but the risk is high in immigrants who lacked health care and those who were uninsured, Yadala said. Quote, over the years, we have seen a dramatic decrease in cervical cancer. However, rates have recently leveled off, Faith Sandberg-Rodriguez, Associate Commissioner of Family Clinical Services at Texas Health and Human Services Commission, said in a news release. Quote, half the cervical cancer cases we see today occur among women who have never or rarely been screened. We are encouraging Texans to turn that trend around by resolving to prioritize cervical health. Routine cervical cancer screenings is the most effective way to detect cancer early, and the first step is talking with your doctor, she added in the release. Cervical cancer is the third leading cancer diagnosis in women ages 20 to 39, and the fifth in women ages 40 to 49. According to the Texas Cancer Registry, there were 1,395 new cases of cervical cancer in Texas women in 2019, the release said. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend cervical cancer screenings for women ages 21 to 65. Yadala said the main cause of cervical cancer is the human papillomavirus, or HPV. Quote, it is central to the development of the cancer, and it can be detected in 99% of the cervical cancers. In the era of HPV vaccination, most experts expect a decrease in the incidence of cervical cancer. So, by some of their estimates, if a vaccination rate of 70% is achieved worldwide, we would expect a decrease of 350,000 new cases per year and of 180,000 deaths per year. That's our goal. In Australia, the vaccination rate is more than 70%, and they have 38% reduction in the high-grade dysplasia. Dysplasia is a precancer. Out of all the states, Connecticut has about a 60% vaccination rate. It's one of the highest in the country, and there they have had 18% reduction in high-grade precancer or dysplasia, Yadala said. In Ector County, they have to raise the vaccination and screening rate. Yadala said there are multiple reasons why people don't get the vaccine or screening. Quote, the latest data that I was reading is the vaccination as well as the screening rate has gone down a little bit during the COVID time. People just didn't come because they didn't want to come out of the house. They only came in when they needed the health care absolutely for an emergency situation. But there is still a good amount of people in our community who are there illegally, who are uninsured, who are single moms, and just so busy they do not have the time to be able to take the time for themselves, Yadala said. She added that there are so many variables as to why women are not getting screened. Quote, our goal is to get the rate of the screening HPV vaccination as high as possible for our county, Yadala said. Some of the risk factors for cervical cancer include early sexual activity, multiple sexual partners, high-risk sexual partner, history of sexually transmitted diseases, someone who has had vulvar or vaginal cancer, because those are also caused by HPV, she said. Quote, so someone who has had those, they are also at risk for having cervical cancer, Yadala said. Having your first child at an early age, someone with three or more children, and lower socioeconomic status are also factors. She added that it is more common in the non-white population and patients who are on oral contraceptive pills, immunosuppressed people, and people with chronic illnesses like HIV are also at risk. No genetic predisposition has been clearly identified for cervical cancer. Patients who are younger than 21 have a great effective immune response that can clear HPV in about 8 months or so and can decrease the viral load to an undetectable level in 8 to 24 months. The virus is categorized in high-grade and low-grade. The two most checked for viruses are HPV 16 and 18. Quote, if someone has this on a pap smear, we definitely keep a close eye on that patient's pap smear and will do certain testing if necessary, Yadala said. If a precancer is diagnosed, a portion of the cervix is removed through a procedure called a loop electrosurgical excision procedure, or LEEP. Quote, if someone does have a cancer, the only choice that they have is a hysterectomy, and it's done by a specialist surgeon. They're called a GYN oncologist, not the general gynecologist like myself. They not only take out the uterus, cervix, ovaries, and tubes, they take out lymph nodes and everything. Those patients sometimes need chemotherapy. Sometimes they need radiation. Sometimes they need all of it. The survival rate depends on what stage they are diagnosed in, how much spreading someone had. Our goal is to definitely prevent that cancer from happening and remove, first of all, detect precancerous lesions and remove those before they have a chance to become cancerous lesions, Yadala said. In years past, when a young girl, 12 or 15 years old, went to a gynecologist, she got a pap smear. Now guidelines recommend doing a pap smear at age 21, whether someone is sexually active or not. Someone who is immunocompromised may need one earlier. They do the pap smear and HPV swab. Between the ages of 21 and 29, a pap smear is done, and if it is abnormal, HPV testing is done. But if it's normal, they can come every 3 years for a pap smear. Quote, but between age 30 to 65, the pap smear and HPV testing is recommended to be done every 5 years. But if they don't get HPV testing done, then just the pap smear alone every 3 years, Yadala said. Once a pap smear is not recommended anymore for someone who has had normal pap smears, no history of abnormal pap smears, of precancer or cancer, it's not necessarily because now we are doing HPV testing. When you do HPV testing, you can stretch out the pap smear to at least 3 years to 5 years. Someone who is 65 and above, as long as they have never had an abnormal pap smear, as long as they have never had an abnormal pap smear, as long as they have had documented normal pap smears in the last 10 years, and normal pap smears within the first 5 years, you can discontinue performing the pap smear after age 65, end quote. But if a 65-year-old woman comes in who has not had a pap smear, one should be performed because you don't know what their status or history. Someone who has had a hysterectomy may still need to have a pap smear and HPV test because vaginal cancer, for example, is caused by the same virus. Social media and kids' brains. The story was written by Carol A. Cates, Chief Nursing Officer, Odessa Regional Medical Center. I don't have much of a presence when it comes to social media. For me, the risks of social media outweigh the benefits. I know more than one person who has lost a job. I know a person who was stalked with the help of social media to the point she had to relocate to another city. I know a person whose child was bullied online to the point of suicidal ideation and spent time in a behavioral health facility. Social media is forever, not just those embarrassing photos from high school sticking around for a lifetime, but I have learned it's hard for families to take down a social media page even after someone has died. I do understand why some people like it so much. It's nice to be able to keep in touch with people who are far away, and how it makes it easier to let multiple people know things quickly. Social media, like so many things, is very much a decision we all need to make for ourselves and for our families, and each of us need to weigh the risks and benefits individually. As you are making those decisions for the kids in your life, I hope you consider the recommendations of the Surgeon General, some recent research published in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, Pediatrics, and other pediatric psychiatry researchers. The research on social media not being good for children is growing. Studies of chemicals in the brain in teenagers show they receive an increase in dopamine when social media is used that is very similar to the increase of dopamine seen in cocaine use. Because our brains are set up to like dopamine, it stimulates the reward centers of our brains. Activities and drugs that cause dopamine release become quickly addictive, especially in the brains of teens, because the parts of their brain that respond to dopamine are more hyperactive. Basically, social media is addictive for kids, and the way our brains are set up in the teen years, that addiction is extremely hard to overcome, to the point that it can take the place of any other motivation. The JAMA pediatric study found that the younger a child is, the bigger social media impacts their developing brains. They found that 12-year-olds who frequented social media had less ability to anticipate rewards. In other words, they have less ability to plan for and work toward future rewards than teens who were exposed to social media at later ages. Those same teens had less ability to determine social feedback in the real world. Other studies are showing that children with excessive screen time, including social media, have poorer literary skills and do not use language as expressively. Mental health experts are also finding that teens who spend a great deal of time on social media report increased feelings of loneliness. Unfortunately, teens and older children do not have the experience to know that there is a difference between screen interaction and face-to-face interaction in terms of value and satisfaction. They return to screens because they are addictive and with the hope of decreasing loneliness, but in many ways, just like addictive drugs, the answers they're looking for are not something their addiction can fill. With all of that information, it is easy to understand why the Surgeon General stated in a recent interview, quote, "I personally, based on the data I've seen, believe that 13 is too early. It's a time where it's really important for us to be thoughtful about what's going into how they, young teens and preteens, think about their own self-worth and their relationships and the skewed and often distorted environment of social media often does a disservice to many of those children, end quote. For me and mine, I cannot say I don't feel the same way. I hope this helps you make a more informed decision about how you decide to handle social media in your family.
Transparent floater remains in the eye. Dear Dr. Roach, I have a transparent floater in one eye that stays in the same general area. I went to an optometrist who dilated and took retinal photos of the eye, and they saw nothing. They just told me if I started seeing curtains, light flashes, changes, to return. Nothing different has occurred yet. My brother swears that eating fresh pineapple daily worked for him. What are your professional thoughts on this cure, LM? Answer, floaters are bits of protein in the jelly-like fluid in the back of the eye, called the vitreal humor, which cast a shadow on the retina. Most people know what they are. They are transparent gray specks that seem to float in the visual field. They are most noticeable when looking at something uniform and light in color, like a white wall. Floaters can be normal, but a sudden increase in the number of floaters, especially with any visual change of the type your optometrist mentioned, should cause you to see your eye specialist immediately, as it can indicate a serious eye problem such as a detached retina. The body doesn't have a good way to get rid of these, so they stay in the eye. I think I can guess why your brother thought pineapple might help. Pineapple contains an enzyme that digests protein. Unfortunately, the enzyme is broken down in the gut and doesn't make it into the blood, let alone in the vitreal humor of your eyeballs. A handful of readers have written me about their experience with getting a vitriolectomy, where the vitreous humor is surgically removed along with the floaters. A person would need to be very bothered indeed to undergo vitrectomy for the floaters, but some people do see changes in their vision due to a large number of floaters.
Dear Abby, grandparents make little effort to see grandkids. Dear Abby, I'm 33 with a wonderful husband and amazing kids, ages 4 and 6. I have a close bond with my parents. We live in a city about 80 miles from them. It seems like we are always the ones to do the visiting, and I have to practically beg them to visit me for one overnight visit a year. My house is smaller than theirs, but we offer up our bedroom for their stay. Meanwhile, because my brother still lives at home with my parents, I sleep on an air mattress when I'm there. Abby, I bend myself into a pretzel to make it work for them. And yet there are always excuses why they won't visit. Mom tells me she misses the kids, but she invariably expects me to pack a bag and head that way. It's frustrating. Sometimes our budget is so tight, I don't have the luxury of spending an extra $70 plus in gas for a trip. My financial situation is not her burden, so I never mention it. I brought up just once in the past that she rarely visits, and she really does believe in her head that she visits at least twice a year. When I corrected her, she blew up. I'm not sure how to feel about this. Sometimes it hurts inside like a rejection, and other times I feel like I need to tell myself to grow up. So here I am in the middle with grandkids who love their grandparents who love their grandkids, and if I don't play the mom taxi, how will they see each other? Mom taxi in Tennessee. Dear mom taxi, they won't. And when your mother asks why you have stopped coming, point out that fuel is costly and your budget is very tight. Then suggest that if she wants her grandchildren to remember her when she and your dad are gone, they need to make more of an effort to visit you more than once a year. If their hesitancy is because your house isn't comfortable, suggest they stay at a nearby hotel or motel. P.S. If your mother gets lonely between visits, she can always video chat, as countless other grandparents do today. Dear Abby, my husband and I have been married more than 40 years. As he's grown older, he has become the stereotypical grumpy old man. Although he can be thoughtful, like giving me flowers for my birthday, he's increasingly moody, impatient, and angry. He often rants about politics and other things and won't stop trying to impose his views on me. I agree with some of his opinions, but he gets upset if I disagree. Because I don't want an argument, I either don't respond or leave the room, which also upsets him. Sometimes he apologizes because he knows his ranting upsets me, but shortly after, he resumes doing it. I love him and do a lot of things for him, but living with him can be a downer. Can you suggest any strategies for coping with my grumpy old man? Enduring it in New Hampshire. Dear Enduring It, schedule an annual physical exam for yourself and your grumpy old man. Behavioral changes in an older person should not be minimized or ignored because they could be a symptom of physical or mental illness. Once you know what you are dealing with, take your cues from the doctor or spend less time one-on-one with your husband and tell him why.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.